welcome to Garden Planet. You're with Selena and Karen.
Afternoon, guys.
And at the moment, we're recording from our home, so we apologize in advance if it does sound a little glitchy or not very studio professional. But, you know, we're here for you, and we're going to do this.
That's right.
So,
let's get comfy.
Today's topic, guys, we're going to continue on from where we were last week, which was hunting and collecting botanicals. And Selena went into quite some depth. Very interesting conversation had, yes. Global expeditions, looking for, hunting for plants around the world by empires and the likes.
Yes, and well, we got up to seed banks and I was talking about them. We weren't going to go on to a different planet just yet.
watch this space.
This.
Get your telescope out. Today, Selena's going to talk a bit more about the actual collecting of botanical seeds, seedlings and whatnot. Just going to focus a bit on that side of today. And I will be discussing the plant of the week, which is, drum roll, the kina tree.
Ooh, okay.
Bit of a late drum roll there.
Okay, well.
So let's get started. What have you discovered about collecting, plant collecting, Selena?
Okay, just getting it down to the personal as a gardener myself. When I first started gardening, I didn't have many plants at all.
How long ago did you first start gardening?
I think it's been about 6 years now since I started my own garden. And
Did you always have an interest before that? Or?
I had a sporadic interest in plants, but never was quite serious about it until maybe 6 years ago when I started learning more about it and actually getting my hands dirty and doing it every
so
day.
So you kind of had an interest like with animals, like, oh, I love animals,
yeah.
I like animals.
Yeah.
That kind of, you had an appreciation.
Yeah. My first plant was...
Well, you are a natural because I've seen your garden and I think it's spectacular.
Oh, thanks, Karen.
And, so... This is my opinion, and I've seen a few gardens. You know, I come from a family, my mum and then her mum, my grandmother, and on my other side, my dad's side, they are all avid gardeners. I've grown up with them. Maybe not so much organic gardeners stuff, different sort of style, more of a, what do they call that kind of garden, display, ornamental, although mum can easily grow tomatoes and, you know, vegetables and whatnot. But yeah, most of my family was more on the ornamental side of gardening. Mm-hmm. And I still have got so far to go with like my level of gardening. I've still got so much more to learn. I've still had plenty of failures. I'm definitely better than when I started. Mm-hmm. But I've been doing it. My point is, I've been doing it since I was definitely more than 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say probably closer to 20.
Yeah.
On and off. So obviously when I was overseas, no. When I was flatting and at uni, no. You know, I had other priorities at times, but yeah.
It's such a wide...
On and off, yeah. Plus years.
Wide, what do you call it? Discipline, hobby, pastime, occupation. that you might never come to the end of it because... I was looking up the World Flora Consortium, which is like a gathering together of all the international botanic gardens and scientists who classify all the plants. And the UN have made a kind of ruling that they want to conserve the plant diversity of the planet. But to do that, they need to identify as many plants as they can from around the world. So they've made this consortium where all the botanical institutions put in all their plants that they have into a big database called the World Flora. And so far,
Can I ask you something?
Yes.
What does consortium mean?
Where's my dictionary? It means like
I think it's like when you group
gathering together of
that. I don't know. That would be my guess from my English student days.
And gathering
multi-choice question, I would probably pick that one.
It's like you get every botanist to get together and pull their ideas. Well, not just botanists, but any sort of sort of scientist.
Like a gathering of knowledge.
Yeah.
Cool.
So I went on the website and it said they had gathered together 1,325,205 different unique plant names that they've identified.
I struggled hearing you a bit then, Selena. I think you were moving away from the mic. Sorry, what was the number of plants that they've got in here?
1,325,205 different names of plants. That's quite a bit.
Yes.
And the other day The other day I went round my own garden and I was counting all the different plants that I could identify. And so I made a count and I got 115 different kinds of plants that I could identify. So that is a very small percentage.
115?
Yeah, 115. All different types of plants. So
that seems a lot to me.
Yeah, it seems quite a lot, doesn't it? I suppose my garden is quite
diverse. And the thing is, I think you should be really pleased with that. And the thing is, like, there's a lot of the plants in that consortium that, you know, obviously there's a lot of trees that you wouldn't be able to fit into your backyard.
It's not.
You know, and plants that would not grow due to, you know, the type of plant it is in your backyard. Mm. So you've got to allow probably, I think you could probably safely say you should be able to grow about, you know, 500,000 plants within reason.
Yeah.
In your backyard, so
you might have to wipe out the lawn.
Planting on the roof.
The roof. I haven't done that yet, and I haven't done much indoor gardening yet, but I will tell listeners that my very first plant was an indoor plant, and I remember it. I don't still have it though. It was a zebra plant, and that was I remember that. It didn't grow very big, though. It just kind of stayed
the
same.
Are they meant to be outdoors?
No, it's an indoor zebra plant. So it had, like, leaves that were striped like a zebra, green and white.
So was it just your lack of gardening prowess?
Yes, that was my very first plant, so I didn't...
What would you say went wrong? Was it the size of the pot?
Possibly I didn't repot it.
As a experienced gardener
I would say probably maybe the temperature wasn't quite right for it because it's a tropical plant.
Novice mistake, Selena.
Yeah. No, I didn't overwater it. I was very thankful.
Easily fixed, though. Easily fixed. You just move it.
Yes. Well, if I went back in time, I probably would know what to do now.
Is hindsight a wonderful thing? I find it quite annoying, actually.
Well, I have killed quite a few plants in my time because I didn't really know what to do with them. So
I just call it my bit to the world's compost heap, you know? And I try to think of death in that light, that it's us giving our bit back when we die to the land that has given so much to us over the years. You know, it's the least I can do. So I try not to think of my planting failures as a complete loss. And also the joy of gardening, just getting your hands in the soil, being in the fresh air, trying new things sometimes. It's quite exciting. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't work out. And then if you are able to learn from it, gosh, I sound like a teacher now, you get a learning experience from it. Wow, how cool is that?
That's because you are a teacher, Karen.
Oh, yes, that's right. But I just don't feel like it at the moment because I'm stuck in my house all the time.
It's got to come out somehow, doesn't it?
Yeah, it always does.
Okay.
Yeah, my poor child is having to suffer it.
Well, when you're starting out gardening and you're quite serious about getting plants for your garden, what I did was look at lots of plant catalogues to see what different types of plants there were and how to care for them. What I looked at was the Palmer's Manual of Trees and Shrubs, and I had all these books that had different, so encyclopedia type books of all different plants. It's just fascinating looking at them all.
Did you find the books? I don't know if asking a librarian is the right thing to do, but I'm going to. Yeah. Did you find the books more or less useful than just chatting with people that have gardened before, or just general hands-on experience?
Well, I think they did come in handy to get to know the names and things, and it will...
Okay, so I think it's a mixture, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both. I mean, you sort of can't really have one without the other, because I've worked with gardeners who didn't have a lot of plant knowledge and were kind of doing it trial and error. And then others that had, like, all the encyclopedic knowledge but didn't have practical experience. So I think there's a bit of both in there. So some of these...
And that's why these consortiums are so good, because it's always good to have, you know, something written, written knowledge passed on from people that have experienced certain conditions or certain factors or issues when growing plants. And you can look back and go, oh, that's right, that person did this when that happened to their plant, or, oh, that's right, this plant grows well in, you know, dry areas, or, so it's just a handy thing to have, because, let's face it, I think some of the issues that gardeners face today are not always the same issues that, you know, elder gardeners faced. I mean, different times, different challenges, different bugs.
True. I was just going to add that when I was learning Rumoa, the very first thing we did was to identify different plants. That's the very first basic building block of knowledge before we start to work with the plants, is just to get to know them, see their names, the shape of the leaves, the flowers, where they grow, what they like.
And you were working with a teacher.
Yes. So
a healer and with immense knowledge.
Yes. So I could.
And I find people like that, even people like my mother, who knows a huge array of plants, I can just point to anything. She's a bit like you, and I can go, what's that? Oh, that's a such, but people know the Latin name and everything, and she'll tell me it's that, because you can see if you look under the leaf or what, that she's just got such a knowledge. She's a clever lady, and so, you know, whereas if I saw the same plant in a book, it's not quite the same. I must say, the photography that you get there these days, and the technology you get, where you've got those apps that can identify plants and all this and that, it does make it easier. It's not like you're looking at a sketch, but what was the botanist on the Endeavour, you know?
Yes,
certainly wouldn't want to look at my sketches.
Some of those sketches, though, the original ones, are real lifelike and quite amazing to look at.
I wonder if, as a botanist back in the day, you had to be a good artist as well.
You definitely had to be a one that was could represent things from real life. Like, you couldn't use your imagination. You just had to draw or paint what was there and make it as true to life as possible. But what they did was they would collect specimens of the, say, the leaves and dry them and send them back to these huge, they called them herbariums, and they would preserve all those leaves and seeds and everything in big containers and cards, so that every plant, every new plant they didn't know, had a, like, a record. And that was the beginning of the botanical institutions. So, and that was all connected with the botanic gardens. So one of the biggest ones was Kew in London, and that is probably the biggest one in the world still. And they tried to collect plants from all over the world. Just, they wanted to know everything. So
gardens around the world once upon a time were government owned or government funded, because they were a part of something very, very important to leaders at that time, which was sourcing as many plants that they could that would benefit their country. So it was seen as an enterprise almost, having a good botanical garden set up.
So they had to...
Whereas now, say, we've got the Auckland Botanical Gardens, or even the one you were talking about in London. Are they private-owned, or...?
They originally...
Oh, so council-owned.
Privately owned, but commissioned by, like, the royals. And then they've become scientific institutions in the name of science that they were doing it. So I think originally they were... by the crown, like the king and queen would send out the...
But yeah, they were very seen as very serious operations. So they would have preserved things, you know, very carefully and looked into things really closely and made a lot of notes and all that.
So even now...
Wow. Because like today, you'd like, if someone goes, oh, let's go... Let's go to botanical gardens on Saturday. It's sort of like it's just a sort of a fun sort of novelty thing to go and do, you know. It's like, oh, yeah, lovely, what a lovely way. But they were actually, I wonder if the public were allowed into them.
Eventually when they had to to pay their way, to pay for the maintenance, to allow visitors in, it's become attractions. But yes, they originally were trialling plants from different parts of the world to see if they would grow in that environment or in the greenhouses and things, just to see if it would take, I suppose, and then introduce them to the general public through the nurseries and everything, and then make some money off
the commons were allowed access.
Speaking of commoners, when I looked on the Kew Gardens website, they were talking about how wealthy gardeners, like the ones who had designer gardeners, were sort of endangering African cycads. You know what cycads are? Those big palm, like, designer plants. They can sell up for, like, thousands of dollars. Well, they were getting those ones from Africa and from the wild to put in their fancy gardens, and they were kind of depleting.
And this was back in the...
No, this is now.
1800s?
No, this is now.
Oh, now.
So they're endangered now.
And
in the wild.
Well, and if they put them on a boat or a plane or whatever, they do travel quite well, I assume, being a robust sort of palm.
Yeah. But they like cost $20 a seed, and they take ages to grow. So some things of collecting is not actually beneficial for the natural, like the wild habitat of where these plants originally come from.
That's a sad side of collecting. Actually, that brings me to a point to be made in my plant of wheat, the Gina tree. This one was also savagely harvested for its health properties. Shall we crack into that now? Would you like
to know more? Of
the week. Of all the saddest words that I have ever heard, the saddest is a story told me by a bird. It spent about an hour chatting with a flower. Here's the
Let's go to our fun of the week, Karen. I'm
a lonely little Yes, so the Kina tree. Cintona officinalis is the Latin name. Mm-hmm. And I found some interesting facts out about this tree, Selena, from the National Geographic magazine, actually.
Yes.
And quite relevant to the June 2020 edition. So okay. I just made some notes, so I'm going to share them now because it's a very relevant tree and you'll soon find out why. As scientists the world over search for a way to prevent and treat, voila, COVID-19. Mm-hmm. Some Brazilians have turned to a plant locally known as quina. And it is often found in the Amazon and other rural communities. And it is used to combat malaria and other inflammatory conditions. The tree is said to have inspired what would later become hydroxychloroquine. Do we agree it was hydroxychloroquine?
Mm-hmm. Hydroxychloroquine, yeah.
A medication that we've heard of being touted by the US President, Mr. Trump. However, the unfortunate thing is that there's no real solid scientific proof behind this hydroxychloroquine. But let's go back to the beginning, 1638. After visiting the Amazon rainforest in Peru, the Spanish Countess of Chinchon fell ill with a high fever and was treated by a local indigenous group with a bitter substance called quinquina. To her delight, the fever receded, and she was cured of what we now know was malaria. Following this event, the quinquina tree was later given the genus name Cinchona in the Countess's honour. Centuries later, scientists discovered that this particular variety of Cinchona was a source of the compound
Quinine,
which would later inspire, thank you Selena, synthetic drugs including hydroxychloroquine. And the next little thing I want to discuss is under the title Substitute Tree, and it goes like this. As Europeans continue to extract cinchona for malaria fighting molecule, the Peruvian tree was pushed to the brink of extinction.
Oh no.
So the following century, a call went out to find substitutes for this bark. And they went looking in the Amazon forest, and as a result of this, several plants were found and given the name quina. However, they were not sources of quinine. Instead, they were alternative trees, and they contained other alkaloids, which are natural chemicals that are also bitter, like quinine.
Okay.
But a lot of them are very toxic and should not be ingested. And apparently, a lot of Brazilians are out there ingesting this type of bark, and it really shouldn't be ingested.
Oh, so you've got to be really careful which tree that you're sourcing the quinine from, because it's not...
Yes, that's
it
right.
It could be similar, but it's not the actual one.
And then it got me thinking about quinine and what it does and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So I looked into that.
Yeah.
Even if these alternative trees did contain quinine, that still would not make their derivatives equal to that of hydroxychloroquine. And this is because while quinine is a naturally occurring compound, the active ingredient in hydroxychloroquine is synthetic and actually has a completely different chemical makeup. So it may have similarities to that compound, but it is not that compound.
Okay, so is it effective at all, this hydroxychloroquine?
Yes, it's used today to treat malaria and other diseases. However, quinine pills, which are probably a more pure sort of quinine, probably just the bark broken down or something into a pill form, are still used as an alternative treatment when the disease shows resistance to these newer synthetic drugs.
Okay. So the resistance isn't to the natural, but it's to the synthetic. That's interesting.
Yes, it is very interesting. So if you are interested in taking this drug, just be aware that although the doctor will be saying, oh, you know, this is great for this illness, it's not, yeah, it hasn't been scientifically proven.
No.
And it is not, a lot of people say, oh, you know, it's the same drug that they use to fight malaria, you know.
But it's not, it's synthetic.
But you've got to ask, well, which drug are you talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
And that the hydroxychloroquine is proving to be, it's not as strong as, you know, it doesn't always work. So they're having to go back to the original source. It is also important to acknowledge that plants don't produce anything specifically just for human and human needs. We sometimes forget that. They produce these chemicals so that they can survive and defend themselves. And a lot of what they produce is toxic, or at least toxic to us. So even if you're just making a harmless, say, bark tea, although it's probably safer than taking some of the pharmaceutical medications out there, it's not always...
Yes, got to be careful.
Natural substance, like bark.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not only the desired substance that is extracted. You're also extracting other chemicals produced by the plant, and this can lead to dangerous results. And also, this one piece of bark is not the same as another piece of bark. You can... especially if it's, you get a different piece of bark from a different season, because
that's
plants
true.
Change
yeah.
during the season. So sometimes they produce certain substances and others they don't. So chemical compositions can change. So you really, it's a real science to it, and you've got to know what you're doing. So just be careful. Yeah.
That syntonin tree won't grow here, will it, Karen?
No.
No.
It grows in Indonesia and India.
Yeah.
Did you find any other sources of where you get it?
Parts of Africa, it said. So in the tropical climate.
Yes, in the tropical zone.
Where malaria is often common.
So they really were... I'm surprised they didn't find... Because Amazon's tropical, isn't it? Or is it subtropical? I don't know why they had to struggle finding it then. It would probably grow there quite easily.
Oh, it's probably because in the forest there's so many different other trees around that they'll have to hunt for a bit to find
one.
Whereas if you cultivated it intensively, you can control where you find it.
Sounds to me like they just went, oh, this one looks close enough.
Oh, no. So do your plant ID, gardeners, because that's very important.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Consult that book, what was that book that you talked about?
Oh, the Palmer's Tree Shrub Manual, or the World Flora Index, or...
Yes. That would be online as well, I'd imagine.
Got millions. So, yeah.
There's lots of resources out there you can use, really.
All right. So, thanks for that, Karen. It's always interesting to learn a new plant or a... unknown plant to me anyway.
Oh, it's been an interesting journey. It's given me a bit more insight, especially with the current pandemic. So it's good to know these things, eh, Selena?
Okay, yep. Like, knowledge is a good thing. So gardeners, keep collecting and hunting for those plants, because you never know what you might find.
Yeah, that's right, guys. Keep the knowledge flowing as well.
All right.
And keep safe.
Happy gardening, and bye for now.
Bye.
Thanks for listening, everyone. That's all we have time for. Come back next week for more great gardening tips at Garden Planet. You can find us on Facebook on our Garden Planet Facebook page, or email us at gardenplanetfm@gmail.com if you want to ask us anything about gardening. Happy gardening, everyone, and we'll be back next week.